This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 78, brought to you in association with Synchron, Archover and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Alex Michelin, co-founder of property fintech CapitalRise, to discuss a 30,000 feet overview of UK property investment and fintech's role and potential in that. The team of eight at CapitalRise has over 75 years of direct property investment experience between them. CapitalRise was founded by Alex and Andrew Dunn, who spent the previous 20 years acquiring, developing, and selling over £1 billion of real estate. We'll come on to CapitalRise and Alex later, but it's worth noting for the moment that the two founders co-invest personally in every deal that CapitalRise does. Let's go back to property, or rather UK residential property, aka houses, aka homes. Most folks I've ever met live in one, and in the UK, most homes are owned by their occupants, about two-thirds, I believe. As I've said before, it's been one of the biggest political failures of my lifetime. The property prices have skyrocketed and are now something like 8 to 10 times the average pre-tax salary. This reminds me of the definition of a politician as someone who takes your money and spends it to bribe you to vote for them. Rising property prices produced a feel-good factor, but only for those on the ladder, which in turn reminds me of the Native American saying that the white man is the only man who steals from his grandchildren to feed himself. David Graeber has pointed out that in our society there's an inverse relationship between how useful you are and your salary, i.e. those folks who would be really missed if they disappeared off the face of the planet overnight, let's say teachers and nurses, are paid the least. It's a social disgrace that these folks are all but priced out of the property market together. But the property market is a problem for everyone. As the average first-time buyer in London is now 39, what are they to do with their savings they're putting aside in the meantime? Leave it in a bank account earning almost nothing and see their failings fall behind property inflation? Invest it in the stock market? Put it in a property fund with all the attendant costs? At the opposite end of the net asset spectrum, those folks I know who, rather than investing in pensions, have over the last few decades invested in buy-to-let properties have done extremely well. But new regulations are inhibiting this market, in itself a problem as non-owners have to rent and by definition can only rent from landlords. It's probably illegal under some regulation I don't even know about to give any advice whatsoever on anything these days unless one's got some certificate from the very same state that created the problem in the first place. So I'm not going to give anyone any advice. How could I if I don't know who you are and actually I don't know anything myself? But what we can hope to do here today is to delineate options and areas that it's worth you checking out, whether you are, quotes, young and need to save for your own home one day, or, quotes, old and need to save for the day when you escape the rat race for a life of daytime TV or travelling around the world, depending on how well your investments have performed. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on the show.
And you suggested that I didn't start the show by saying, so I hear you're a mate of Hugh Hefner, the Playboy Empire owner. So, as you don't know me that well, you see that's clearly sort of red rag to the bull saying I shouldn't do something. So I'll start the show by saying, so I hear you're a mate of Hugh Hefner's.
Well, not quite, but thank you for bringing that up. I just happened to be one evening having dinner with a very good friend of mine in a restaurant in London, and who should turn up and sit on the next door table but Hugh Hefner? And the great part of this was he wasn't alone, clearly. He was with seven girls, all blonde and all very attractive and not wearing very much. So needless to say, my friend and I had one of the best nights we've had. He got pretty hammered. His cake came at 80th birthday. We all sang and we all ended up going to a nightclub with him, and he paid for the whole night. So yeah, it was a brilliant night, but I wouldn't call him a friend, but I do have a couple of very funny photos.
Oh, brilliant. Well, that will come in useful when you need to do a fundraising round, and it hasn't taken off quite as fast as you thought. Well, I should have mentioned earlier, actually, that we're in sort of the heart of Chelsea here, and Chelsea is a place for those overseas listeners who haven't visited London, where if you haven't got a Ferrari, you're basically a pauper. I've seen more Ferraris in the last sort of 10 minutes walking here than I have for some time. So my sort of inner male self, green with envy, of course, at Mr. sort of Hefner's luck with the ladies. Well, maybe it's not luck, actually. Maybe it's sort of skill with his career. But I was rather sort of sitting there wondering how much sort of 80-year-old Mr. Hefner could be entertained, shall we say, by eight ladies for an entire night, or whether this has got something to do with the price of a rhinoceros horn, but I don't really know, and I would probably not ask you that, actually. So, moving on from sitting next to magnates in Pret-a-Manger, or wherever it was that you were all celebrating, how come you entered this starry world of property and these wonderful offices that we're at? And I must say, it's the first fintech, although you can explain the distinction, that I've walked into that's got a sort of marble plaque as you walk through the door on the floor with gold lettering of the name. So that's really very good.
So, yeah, I started my career in banking, and I worked in HSBC in investment banking. And to be honest, it was pretty boring. And my business partner and I, a very good mate of mine from school, were talking one day, and we decided that actually London's property market needed better quality of housing, and we decided to try to solve it. Sounds pretty crazy. We were about 22 or 3 at the time, I think. Anyway, long story short, so said, so done. We both quit our jobs and we started on a property escapade. We bought our first flat in Mayfair, a small ground and lower ground floor flat, redid that up and, you know, sold it and managed to make a mediocre profit. Fell out with the builders, but we thought, you know what, let's try another one. So we went from there, and long story short, in the last 20 years, we've done well over £1 billion of real estate investment, and we have currently £1 billion in our pipeline to sell, and that's in my main business, Finchatten.
Which is, to be clear, the marble plaque that is you walk over as you come in, and it's not Capital Rises yet.
Yeah, so Capital Rise has been spun out of Finchatten because really we as developers have seen a massive pain point, and Capital Rise is here to fill that need.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, one of the earliest podcasts I did in 2014 was with Christian Faes of LendInvest, and a bit like you guys, he got a background in doing property and really knowing the property market in the first place before he did the sort of fintech twist on it. And
he's done pretty well.
He's done okay, yes. I haven't seen him recently. I don't know how he spent his $40 million from his new Chinese friend or something like that. I bet he's got marble everywhere. And you've clearly sort of lived it, and you sensibly escaped the sort of city as it was getting rather sort of tedious, and it's even more tedious now, I think. There is something about people who have been successful in property, and I've met sort of one or two now and then. I don't know whether it's because you actually have to deliver something. I was talking to, I should anonymize this one, I was talking to a friend of mine recently about the life of consultants and people who sort of send emails and go to meetings and all this kind of stuff, and it can be so intangible and such bullshit and such vaporware, such nothingness, actually. And we were watching, talking of property, a program on YouTube. I tend to watch YouTube on the TV these days, about Taipei 101 or whatever it was, which at one point was the tallest building in the world. And we were contrasting people in the building industry, or I've given away who it is. We're contrasting people in the building industry where it's very clear that you either succeed or you don't in building a 101-story building, and then it either stands up or it doesn't when there's an earthquake and a typhoon on the same day, as opposed to this more intangible sort of change project-y stuff where not a lot happens. So, yes, I think property people have got this thing. I mean, they've got lots of things, but somehow you have to actually be successful to keep doing what you're doing and end up with a billion. I don't know. What's it like from the inside?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, my banking world, one of the reasons I left, as you say, was because it was a lot of corporate finance nonsense, and you stand there and talk about this and that, and it's all just hot air. And actually, at the end of the deal or the end of the transaction you've done, all you've got is a piece of paper that someone signed. And there's nothing really sort of that seems tangible that you're benefiting, you know, the society with. Something that attracted me about property development is that we actually build homes. You know, I can stand there and look at a home that we've built and a building that we've built now and say we did that in 2010 and that's the one from 2012. And, you know, we put a little plaque at the bottom of each of our buildings because we want to always make sure that they stand the test of time. So you're absolutely right. And I'm, you know, I'm very lucky that I've sort of had this opportunity to do this because it's been very, very great fun. I mean, I've really enjoyed it.
Yes, and I guess that, again, comparing it to more intangible work in many other sectors, and we're not just talking about finance here, it is very evident whether you succeed or not. I mean, you buy a building at X, you spend Y on the development costs and all this kind of stuff, and then you sell it for Z, and if Z is less than X plus Y, you lose money and eventually you disappear.
You live or die by your last deal, as we always say.
Yeah, exactly, and eventually, if you've been doing it for sort of 20 years or whatever it is now, then having a sort of marble thing on the entrance is signalling the fact that actually you've been very successful. Unlike being a trader and having a Rolex watch or something like that,
yeah.
Well, all you're signalling is actually you're managed to be a incumbent somewhere and you've got yourself into a seat, as Warren Buffett puts it,
yeah.
That comes with money attached to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, we've always tried to be frugal. We have our offices in Chelsea. They're not in, you know, the centre of Mayfair.
So just translating for the thousands of listeners out there, this is only a property person in London would call Chelsea frugal.
Well, I guess I just mean that if you're going to do property in London, typically you'd be in Mayfair where rents are 150 quid a foot. You know, we're sitting here in Chelsea in an office that's £50 a foot. So we're still very, very careful, but obviously we have clients coming into the office and we need it to look in a certain way. Otherwise, people won't trust you with their money. So
I didn't realise there was a multiple of three, because for several years I actually did have an office in Mayfair myself, actually, on Berkeley Square. But that's a separate...
Wow. Well, that would be definitely £150 a foot today.
Right. Well, I got it for £0 a foot because I was sitting on the sort of board of a company, actually, and occasional Friday lunch thrown in as well with a private chef, but that's another story. So lots of time in UK property investing and lots of time being very successful. As I intimated in my introduction, there are lots of categories of listener. There is a sort of the early 20-something who's got no money and who may be unlucky enough not to have a bank of mum and dad, which I believe contributes to one quarter of UK property purchases these days. And somehow they've got to create enough money out of thin air to in 10 or 20 years buy their own property. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you can have a sort of bunch of folks who are traders and wear Rolex watches and they've got plenty of money just to invest in stuff. And then you've got people who are tossing up how to invest in pensions or busy getting divorced or something like that. And do they get a buy-to-let? Do they share? Do they buy funds? So let's, in a sense, not worry about them, but let's just try and sort of cover what we mean by property in the UK. I mean, this should be obvious, but like everything, it gets more complicated the more you zoom in. What is property? Why do people buy it? And how do they buy it? And how fintech's changing? I think those are sort of the basic things. So going back to the question, which is probably completely obvious to everybody, what is property from an investment perspective?
In terms of what is property, you have two main segments. You have residential property, which is, as most people will understand, houses and the housing stock in the UK, and that is many trillions in value. And then you have commercial property, which would be all the offices, the shops, the restaurants, the hotels, the sheds. And those are really the two big subsectors. But as you say, when you drill down, it gets a bit more complicated. Within residential, you have your home that you live in, and most people will be sort of trying to buy their own home at some point. And then you also have those who have been fortunate enough probably to have bought their own home, who then go and buy what's called a buy-to-let, and that's for investment, where they buy another house or a flat and they rent it out for income and investment value. And likewise, in commercial, you have, as I say, offices. It's not just all commercial, which have a certain characteristic. You have sheds, which have a very different characteristic. Retail, hotels, all of them have a slightly different nuanced sort of investment thesis.
And so sticking with the top down and just taking a sort of kind of equity analogy. So you've got the sort of FTSE All Share, which in this case we could call the sort of FTSE every property in the country. And that would have two main sort of sub-indices, the residential and the commercial, and we'd have sub-indices with that. And from the little I know about the relative performance of retail and commercial, these two can vary in terms of just an index considerably over the cycle.
Absolutely. So residential has done incredibly well over the long term and has probably outperformed pretty much every other asset class, including stocks and shares, over a long time period. Commercial is a little bit more cyclical and goes up and down very much more with economic cycles, because clearly the value of commercial really comes from the amount of people wanting to rent your office, the amount of shops wanting to rent the shop that might be on the high street, the amount of people going into the pub and the amount of people staying in hotels, and all of those things would go down when we're in recession. So commercial property values typically follow a little bit more closely to sort of your standard market cycle, whereas residential very much is its own beast.
Yes, and presumably there's the question that commercial buildings tend to be bigger and therefore tend to take longer to make. Because just when I spent sort of decades sitting in the city looking out of windows, which is my usual preoccupation in life, you'd see people literally, and I can think of two or three examples, literally taking two or three years just apparently to dig a hole in the ground in the building next door to you with quotes, nothing happening. Of course, they're pile driving and foundations and that kind of stuff. So that would take years. And then suddenly a sort of building would appear out of nowhere in about a year. But that cycle takes years to do, which very few sort of the average private homes in the country do at all. And so I think I've seen a couple of times in the city, you know, huge hosts of cranes all over the place building stuff when the commercial property is actually going down in value.
Yeah, that's
it. It's kind of, I started so I finish.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, what tends to happen, unfortunately, with property REITs and property companies, and I'm not criticizing anyone, I hope, here. But I think what typically happens is when everything's good, they think it's always going to be good, and they carry on building and expanding and doing even bigger projects, when actually sort of the peak of the market is probably when you need to start saying, you know, we're not going to build anymore. But it's very difficult when obviously property values are rising, your stock price is high. So that's why you sort of get this boom and bust a little bit with property, because as you say, time frames are so long, you can't just turn the tap off when you're halfway through a project. So
yes, and without sort of getting too bogged down into how property works, presumably if the residential has outperformed the commercial, presumably it's harder to get planning permission for residential than it is for commercials, because otherwise this thing called supply and demand. I mean, let's say over my lifetime, let's say every year the government had built 10% more residential housing stock, then I presume that residential property would be worth less than it was when I was born.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the main reasons residential has outperformed commercial is because of the housing shortage, and because so many people want to live in the UK. We have all this sort of net migration into the UK, and we're just not building enough homes. I mean, it's widely a political football that gets kicked about, and we never seem to be able to solve it. And part of that is because of the draconian planning laws, which, you know, sort of pervade most of the UK, particularly London. And that's why prices here in London and the rest of the UK are generally going up over a long period of time. And if I could just say on commercial, one of the things that I think has pushed that asset class down significantly, it's just subject to so much change. The internet, you know, high streets are shrinking massively because of the internet. WeWork, shared office spaces, people no longer work in the same way they did 20, 30 years ago. You know, people are working in Starbucks, the gig economy, all of these things have a massive impact on commercial, whereas residential, let's be honest, everyone just needs a place to live. And I'm not sure much is going to change that. You know, everyone wants to have a home. We need a home over our head. It's a very basic human instinct. So commercial has sort of not performed quite as well as residential over the long time period.
Yes, and it is part of the globalization of UK society over the period that plenty of foreigners who weren't here 50 years ago are here, and they wanted to slice the action as well. I always think of a guy I sat next to at school in maths, and about the age of 11, I actually saw him recently again. And his father was a doctor, and when he was a trainee doctor, he lived in Chelsea, because in whatever it was, the 1950s or something, or 40s, that's where trainee doctors could live, and Chelsea was more run down. And now you've got to be sort of not quite an oligarch, but you've got to be nearer an oligarch than a junior doctor to actually be living here. Okay, so anyway, so there's different categories there, very different categories: residential, commercial, buyer beware, and don't mix up the two if you're looking to invest in this directly or indirectly. And then we come into the simple question, apparently simple question, of why invest in property? Well, as you say, because you live there, and you decide that it's, in the long run, it's cheaper buying your own place than just paying rent to somebody else. So you live there, or as an asset in its own right, because it just historically has gone up, and maybe it keeps going up. And then I think a sort of slightly sort of subtle third version of that is kind of in between, which is that for this kind of archetypal 21-year-old that's got to wait 18 years until he can invest in a property, if there is some way, and this is probably via a fund or fintech or something like that, that he can be putting away some money every year into a savings fund that, shall we say, matches the cost of a Barrett's house in a field in Surrey that doesn't actually exist but will exist in 15 years' time, that he'll eventually be able to buy,
it's like a
good match
hedge
for him.
It's a natural hedge against that, yeah.
And you mentioned the optimism of people in commercial property about stuff going up and up when it is going up and up, and you know, this is an impossible question really, so it's probably a good one to ask, but we can be quite sure of the past. Actually, we can't be quite sure of the past. My younger daughter's doing a history A-level at the moment, and I think if you could be quite sure of the past, there wouldn't be much of a history A-level, because a bit like maths, you just say this is the right answer, you know. Most history TV is a bit like that. Hitler was a bad guy, etc., etc., although they never cover things like the sort of 100 years war. Going forwards, again, for overseas listeners, for about 60% of the audience these days, I ought to explain that nobody in the UK can face mentioning the Brexit word these days. But in theory, if it all goes badly, I can't see this happening, but if it all goes badly and millions of EU people sort of disappear back off to continental Europe, this in theory could mean that property prices went down, in theory?
It could in theory. I mean, who knows what's going to happen. I think the government have all come out saying that anyone who's living here from Europe will not need to leave already. So I don't see a sort of mass exodus. I think around the edges we may lose some bankers, we may lose some business, of course. But, you know, the sort of flip side to that is potentially London becomes like the Singapore of
of Asia, where, you know, we're just on the edge of Europe as Singapore is to sort of China, and, you know, but much more efficient, better tax regime, sort of a nicer place to live, we speak English, etc., and then becomes even more attractive. I mean, who knows with the corporation tax going down to where it is. One thing I would say Brexit has done is certainly reduce the value of sterling, which obviously has made it England much more attractive, the UK much more attractive for foreign investment so far in terms of buying into property. It looks like London's on sale for most foreign buyers. But, you know, there are so many ifs and buts and questions that who knows really where we'll be. All I would say personally is London's been around for obviously hundreds and hundreds of years, has always been one of the centres of the world. And fundamentally, I don't think Brexit will change that. It may be a bump in the road. It may reinforce it. It may cause, you know, unknown consequences. But London is a very attractive place to live because of all the things we know, culture, English language, time zone.
And employment as well in this supposedly sort of smartphone interwebby world where you can live from a beach and work from a beach, actually. More and more people end up having to work in London, even if they want to escape. No, I agree about that. I mean, I think that, you know, the main risk to retail property prices is there's a very high ratio, which is only sustainable because interest rates are basically bugger all at the moment. And I can't see this happening, but if interest rates went back to where they used to be when I were a lad, like 15%, that would be an utter disaster, and
that would cause
a crash. And again, you know, the value of all of your investments can go down as well as up, even the ones that you think can't, especially the ones. And when I was running fixed interest management, there was a certain intake of new graduates in 1 year, and they all sort of bought out their sort of small flat as soon as they could. And then the property market went down, and they were all screwed, and they were extremely stressed by it. Mm. So we talk about it as an investment class, but there's something much more personal about a house. And when you meet people who are significantly underwater in their mortgage and have just calculated how many more decades of their life they will have to work unless inflation bails them out, it is actually quite painful. So it's important to get it right. Okay, so I think people probably in the first case knew sort of roughly what property was and the reason to buy it. So then we come on to things where people probably know all of this but will not know the sort of cost-benefit analysis of it, which is in terms of how do you buy it. Well, actually, you can just go and buy one with all the attendant hassles of that. Most people, I think, buy houses with mortgage, i.e. from an investment perspective, they're geared, they're leveraged, which is one reason they've made money. I mean, I didn't know, you put 10% down as a deposit or something and borrow 90%, so it's a bit like in horse racing terms, you're gambling with 10 times the money you've got and borrowed to do the rest. So there's direct investment, there's buy-to-let, as you say. There are sort of property funds, unit trusts. There are these REITs, REITs, whatever they're called, which are a type of investment trust in the UK, and then we go on to fintech. So just sticking with the kind of, quotes, old-fashioned ways of buying, what are the sort of pros, cons, and costs and of putting your money in, whatever type of money, whether it's pension money or it's savings money, into property?
Sure.
Via these routes?
Sure. So I think the direct route, as you've said, firstly, let's talk about just buying your own house. Clearly quite attractive because you get a utility value from that by living in the house. And you also get potentially an investment value because that may go up over time and you hope it will. So that's a very easy one to do, but it requires a lot of capital to buy a home typically. And you pay lots of taxes, stamp duties, etc. to buy your own home. But I think most people would want to do that. You then go into buy-to-lets, and again, similar to buying your own home, big stamp duty costs. The government have made it less efficient to hold buy-to-let properties with...
I've forgotten how they've done that again.
They've reduced the interest relief that you can claim on your buy-to-let property. So you used to be able to claim your full tax band interest relief. So if you're a 40% rate taxpayer, you could claim the entire 40% off your interest, but now they're only allowing you to reclaim interest at the basic rate, so you lose quite a big incentive there, basic rate of tax. So, you know, I think both of those are nice, but they're quite unwieldy and quite difficult for most people because you need a lot of money, probably hundreds of thousands of pounds, to do either buy-to-lets on your own or buy your own home. And probably people can do it once, i.e. buy their own home, but quite difficult to go and buy lots and lots of buy-to-lets.
Certainly, you know, when I've bought, I bought three properties in my lifetime, and it's an absolute nightmare. Part of which is the sort of the UK law, and offers aren't firm until they're firm,
and it's gazumped and all this
awful
stuff.
I mean, it's notorious over here as being one of the sort of three biggest stresses in life. I think buying a house, dying, and getting divorced or something like that. So you don't do all those three at the same time. You're probably best off dying before you do the other two, because it's just simpler that way round. And when you say buy to let, talking divorce, when I got divorced, I rented a house for many years, which then I just bought because it was just simpler than going and buy another one. And the landlady was in Singapore. You mentioned Singapore beforehand. And of course, it was a huge pile of hassle for her when, I don't know, the boiler break or something like that. So it's not actually possible to do it yourself. So she had some, I don't know, whatever they call managing agents or something like that, who did all the stuff, who charged her a pretty penny and then some on top. And even then they didn't always sort it out, so she would occasionally have to get involved in stuff. So
it's a very good point.
Quite a hassle.
So even with buy-to-lets, you've got to pay agents' fees to rent it out. You've got to every year find a new tenant. You've got to clean the place. You've got to fix it up. You've got to give it a lick of paint. I mean, it is a hassle, but you hope that it's worth it in the long run. So I think what a lot of people then do is say, to hell with that, I don't have the time, I've got a day job, I've got too much on. So they invest in property stocks, and that includes REITs and property funds. And a REIT really is just a property company where you're giving them your money and they can invest it how they see fit. And to qualify to be a REIT, you just have to pay 90% of the income these companies
and
receive.
And it's an investment trust.
It's an investment trust.
So a closed-end fund for us.
Yes.
Listed closed-end fund.
Yes, and with daily liquidity on the market, you can buy and sell these shares. But my issue with that is what you're really doing is, A, giving someone else your money to manage, in a sense, because you're saying to some property person, here, off you go, do what you will with this. And therefore, the fees are a lot higher, because what you're basically doing is paying a property company, paying all of their staff, all of their management. And what these property companies often do is then employ a developer, employ people below them, who they also have to pay fees to do the actual property developments and deals for them. So you're paying sort of at least two levels of fees there. So you're cannibalizing massively the potential returns you can get out of property.
So, for a bear with a very simple brain like me, we seem to have conflated two things, or at least in my mind, two things have got conflated, although I'm sure they're quite clear in your mind. So from my simple perspective, we started to talk about buying properties. So for the sake of argument, let's keep it really simple. I list a REIT on the London Stock Exchange, and I raise, I don't know, £50 million, and I spend £10 million and I buy a flat in Chelsea, and I spend another £10 million and I buy a flat in Mayfair, and blah, 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 basically sort of a bunch of buy-to-lets. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of sit there and do nothing, and I pay some local agents to fix the broken pipes or something like that, which is like a REIT of BTLs, which is kind of just basically a simple direct investment. But also you mentioned development. Now, again, to a simple person like me, development means that I buy somewhere, I spend a lot of money doing it up, and then I try and sell it again, which is a more sort of transactional type thing. So why am I getting confused? Or are there just different REITs that do different things?
Yeah, I mean, not wanting to be pedantic, but REITs can't hold residential buy-to-let property, so they wouldn't be able to do that.
That's not so much pedantic as accurate.
Yeah. But I guess what I mean is that typically these property companies would go out and hold an investment. So your example is a good one. Let's say it's a commercial investment. But instead of them running that commercial investment, they hire a managing agent who runs that commercial investment for them. So if you bought it yourself, you would go and hire that managing agent yourself. Now what you're doing is you're paying a property company, so you're paying all their staff, their office costs, their overhead, and all they're then doing is paying a managing agent to also manage it on their behalf. So you're losing fees to the managing agent that you would do if you did it directly, but you're also then losing all the fees that the REIT take and the charge and the performance fees the REITs take on all of the assets they're managing on behalf of the shareholders. So you're losing a lot of money. So typically, you might expect to just put some numbers to it. You might expect to make a 15% return, let's say, if you did the development yourself or invested in this thing yourself. The REIT will take 4 or 5% at least of that 15%. So you as the shareholder are left typically earning 10 or less percent. If you did it yourself, you'd probably make 15. So that's what I mean about these layers of sort of management charges.
Absolutely,
that
you're
suffering.
But importantly, the bit that I was omitting was that you can't just use a REIT to invest in a bunch of flats in London and sit on them.
No, you can't.
And is that the same with UK property funds as well?
Yes, I'm pretty sure UK property funds cannot hold residential, cannot hold buy-to-let properties as predominantly their portfolio. They can have some, I think, small amount, but most of it has to be commercial assets.
So going back to the politicians and government being not 100% useless over the period, one can clearly see the logic of that, because if you start getting funds on the stock market which start investing in properties, that makes
it even worse. Exactly. And I think it's also, to be honest, a big PR thing. What they're trying to stop is, little granny in the house being badly treated by this huge sort of Goliath property fund. Anyway.
Yes. Right. Okay. So in terms of where we started, which is what is property, and property is broadly residential or commercial, and they've all got the sort of the subsectors, and they've all got the geographies as well, because of course geography is a massive factor. You mentioned London before. London has performed particularly well. I was hearing recently about properties in a certain road in Liverpool that literally sell for zero at the moment. So properties that in that particular road haven't done so well. So there's no such thing as UK property. There's lots of different regions and lots of different properties. So that's direct investment, that's buy to let. You've then got the property funds, and that's sort of the whole development thing as well, which is a question of the margins in that. So into this mix is suddenly thrown this thing called fintech or prop tech or prop fintech or fin prop tech. So if you can rescue the listeners from complete confusion, so what's a fintech and what's a prop tech and what's a prop fintech and what's a fin prop tech?
So, I mean, I'm not sure there is a sort of universally recognised description.
I don't think it's a universal description of fintech. It's just a convenient label.
Yeah, but my understanding of prop tech would be it's technology which enables and makes property more efficient. And that would be, i.e. holding a property, owning that property.
Or things like Zoopla.
Cleaning the property. Zoopla, correct. It's a search engine for property. It's not a financial investment thing. And fin prop tech is enabling the investment or some sort of financial investment into property. So that would be whether it's, you know, investing in the debt, the equity, it's an investment product rather than just enabling and making property more efficient. So prop techs might be things, for example, that allow you to clean your house a lot quicker, right? Because that's sort of helping you with your property. But the fintech side would be helping you invest in that property or make money from that property.
I see. And, okay, so within... I've forgotten now. I shouldn't have started being silly myself. I confuse myself with this fin prop tech or prop fintech. Anyway, with firms like Capital Rise and fintechs that are using property for, as it were, financial purposes, how does that broadly break down?
Yes, it's a very good question, Mike. And I think, you know, as we've discussed, you have your direct investment into property. In the old world, this was all you had. You had the direct investment into property. You have buy-to-lets, you have property funds, you have commercial property, which you can invest in. And those things all have their advantages and disadvantages. And what the fintechs in the property sector are doing is enabling you to do all of those things or most of those things and benefit from the way you want to benefit most of those things with many fewer downsides. So they would cost a lot less. You can invest with a lot less money. There's a lot less fees, for example, for investing via the fintechs in property than there would be if you did it yourself directly. And so what they're doing is disrupting this really old way of doing things to the benefit of all consumers out there.
And as I was saying before, after several years in this lark, I've got utterly bored of hearing the propaganda that sort of, oh, fintech is using digital to pass on significant savings to the customers. Because quite often it doesn't, actually. So the one that always springs to my mind is online wealth managers, the likes of Nutmeg and that, charge, broadly speaking, pretty much the same. Or they might be slightly lower. They're absolutely not 10 times cheaper. I mean, when it comes to currency transfers, that is an area where you can be about 10 times cheaper. So when you say, and I'm sure correctly, that property fintechs are saving money for the punters, are we talking about they save 10% or they say, roughly speaking, they save 10 times the money?
Depends on the fintech, of course. But I think, let's take my example, Capital Rise. So typically, I think the way a lot of people probably unknowingly invest in property is they put money into their pension fund. Let's just give a really good example. There's billions and billions of pounds sitting in pension funds, and the pension fund manager takes a fee. So he takes a fee for managing your money, and he then says, you know, I'm going to put some of that money into a property fund. So he then puts some of that money into the property fund. That property fund takes a percentage for managing your money, and that property fund then says, no, I'm going to give it to a developer, and that developer takes a fee for managing your money. So you've got at least three layers of fees there, typically. And as I've said before, the property developer at the sort of start of the chain is probably making 20%. He's then paying it to the property fund. That property fund's taking a performance fee and a management fee, typically 2% and 20% of performance. And then they're giving it to the pension fund manager, and he's taking also a performance fee, 2 and 20. And by the time it gets to little old consumer, you and I, we're probably getting about 6 or 7%. So that's why typically our pensions are not performing as well as they should. There's these huge pensions black holes. And what we're doing at Capital Rise is saying to hell with that. We cut out all of those middlemen and we take money from you, the investors, the retail investors, and we give it straight to a property developer who we have vetoed. We check, we procure that property developer to make sure they are absolutely the best in the business. And by doing that, we are able to give our investors between 10 and 18% per year as a return.
Right, which sounds very attractive, assuming that the risk isn't too much, which we'll come on to in a minute. So the first point is that it reminded me of the Woody Allen joke about a stockbroker being a man who invests your money until it's gone.
Yeah.
So the first thing you're doing is just removing, as it were, mixing my metaphors, it is Friday afternoon, buckets of water from the chain of firemen passing it along, so less of the water gets slopped out. So, you know, in a way, there's nothing that's sort of necessarily too digital about that. But, of course, you're right, and it depends on the area, but if you've got a good prop fintech that you're using, you should be overall, one way or another, paying rather less fees than you would be otherwise, and you can do it in smaller sums of money. We'll come on to CapitalWise later, but I think you were mentioning that I can stick £1,000 of my ill-gotten gains through CapitalWise, whereas if I went to go and buy a property in Chelsea, I'd probably need about 10 mil or something like that. But within prop fintech, there are going to be different types, and obviously there is the ones that give you a debt characteristic, like LendInvest and LandBay, who have been on the show already. They're just P2Ps. The property is, and this is how I see it, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the property is just kind of just an asset, really. I mean, the fact is property is obviously important to the people managing it, but it might as well be industrial machinery or something like that. It's just something to guarantee that your loan doesn't go down the pan. You've then got something where you're presumably getting a share of the equity, and then you go down the whole spectrum of, I don't know, property crowdfunding I've seen around, and then development stuff. So that's a good way of doing it, actually. Why don't we just take it down the risk profile? So, you know, the least risky thing, where you're not going to get much upside, to the sort of the riskiest, where you might, but also you get the downside as well.
Very good question again, Mike. I think the sort of most least risky.
The most least, or was it the least most?
The least risky way that you can do this on the sort of property fintech spectrum is investing into the debt of real estate, because it's secured. You're lending against, as you say, an asset which is secured. You can touch it, feel it, get a valuation done on it. And that is the likes of LendInvest and LandBay, and CapitalWise also do that as well. So there you are basically lending money to either buy-to-let investors or to developers who will then go and develop the property. And you are getting a fixed return for doing that. So it's like a debt product, as you've said, and you have security on the asset. So if everything went wrong, they can sell the asset and recoup your investment. And then you go all the way through to the most risky end of that spectrum, which, as you say, is equity, which is where you are, you know, hoping to buy into the future profitability of a development or a property transaction of some kind. And by doing so, you are last in line to be paid, i.e. all the debt gets paid before you, the banks, the LendInvest type investors would all get paid before you. And you hope that there's something and a good profit left, and you are part of the equity. And typically, the ranges of returns for debt would be, depending on where you are in the debt spectrum, would be probably something like 6% to 10, 11%. And the equity spectrum would probably be 12 plus, you know, possibly even going up to 20% if things went well. But clearly on the equity spectrum, you're also taking the risk that you could lose all of your money. You have no security, you're unsecured, you are just, you know, hoping that the expertise of the developer or the property investor in question is going to help you.
And so from what we're talking about here, we've slid like Bambi on a frozen lake across this sort of whole idea about getting direct, simple exposure, as it were. In terms of the fintech categories, we've got the debt category and we've got the equity category, and maybe there's something in the middle in this categorization, or maybe just forget categorization, where I give my money to a fintech and then go and buy a few buy-to-let properties, and unlike LendInvest and LandBay, where they're just lending the money as a debt transaction and I get debt back, I'm investing through a fintech, and actually I've got equity exposure because one day they'll sell this buy-to-let and hopefully in 10 years' time it'll be worth more. And although it's going to be a very liquid transaction for me, I end up getting some equity rise in 10 years' time, going back to this mythical 21-year-old who's trying to save his deposit.
Yes, that is one of the equity characteristics, and part of the equity that we were mentioning is that, you know, if someone like Property Partner, you can invest in the equity in a portfolio of buy-to-let properties. So you actually own a share of the underlying property itself. You're not just in the debt. And you would benefit from an increase in the value of that property over time, yes, as well as getting some of the income in Property Partner's case. But likewise, you can also do that with a development. So you, in the same equity basis, you know, some guy might be developing a block of flats around the corner from where you live. You can crowdfund and invest, you know, through the prop tech into his development and own the equity in that. But he has to then sell that development. He can't live in it himself.
Yes, and I think the development is an industry, and like many industries, when you're inside, you know the sort of good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah.
And when you're outside, it has a kind of vibe or a smell or whatever. So that, you know, there's plenty of people who aren't in the city are going about, oh, these terrible crooks in the city. And I haven't met many crooks, I must say, in 30 odd years. But it's got a reputation. And the same thing with development. You know, I think of development, and I think, well, actually, some of them are dodgy developers. But also, I think of it as terribly high risky. So just for me as an investor, I could broadly get my head around residential investment because I've done it myself, and you know, I occasionally read the newspaper. I could slightly get my head around commercial investment because I know what sort of supermarkets look like and office buildings look like, and I'd have to spend a little bit of time looking up how they've done in the past comparatively. But then I think, ooh, it's like my, you know, development, gosh, that must be a bit risky. I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, I mean, development is definitely on the more extreme level of the risk scale.
but you get the return commensurate with that risk.
Yeah, so, of course, yes.
You know, I would say development, again, is very location-specific. Development in London is very different from developing in Liverpool on certain streets, as you've quite rightly pointed out. So it's all about the demand and supply. And I guess what I love about the revolution and the disruption that the fintech is bringing to this space is that typically development has only been funded by super high net worths. And these guys are putting in, say, £1 million, and they're getting returns of 15, 20% per year. And they've been getting this for decades.
Yes.
That has not been available to your average man on the street. And people like us at Capital Rise and some others out there are now allowing and giving access to these incredible opportunities where you can make 15, 16, 18% returns on your money.
So that is a real, I mean, no cynicism at all here, that is a real democratization.
Absolutely.
You are making available to, for the sake of a cliche, having mentioned David Graeber before, who came up with this phrase amongst a few others, you're making available to the 99% what was previously only available to the 1%.
That's absolutely right.
Excellent. Right, well, we'll come on to sort of Capital Rise in a minute, but before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all of you listeners out there, whatever your exposure is or maybe to UK property, I hope it does well, and my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. Okay, Alex, so having talked about the super big picture of what property is and ways you can invest in it, and then a bit of a topology about how fintech is as such, all of these are a little bit abstract. Let's come on to the sort of the very concrete thing that's been occupying your mind for some time, which is, what is Capital Rise? What has it been doing? What is it doing? And all the listeners out there, what kind of folks should check it out and what kind of things are you selling them?
Thank you. What
is that, enough questions in one sentence?
Yes, quite a few. I'll see if I can answer them all. Capital Rise really is giving your average everyday investor access to these sort of very, very good, in my view anyway, very, very good investment opportunities in prime central London, which, you know, historically have just been unavailable to your average investor. I'm sure they've read about people making money in central London property, but they can't get access to it themselves unless they have these huge amounts of money.
And Finn Chatton's background is in luxury property design.
It is, and development. So it's very much a sector that we understand, and we pick and choose which developments are put onto the platform, and we as founders put our own money into every single investment alongside the crowd. You can invest from as little as £1,000, and the returns are between 10 and 18%, depending on what you want. You can either decide to lend money to the developer, which is less risky, secured, as we've talked about, a bit like LendInvest, but our returns are slightly higher. Or you could invest in the equity portion of that development as well and take a bit more risk and say, you know what, yes, I'm going to try and get a little bit more of the return, but I'm willing to take on that risk. So it really is brand new. It's sort of not been there before. We're growing very, very fast, and we'd be keen to have as many of your listeners who want to get involved with us as possible.
And the minimum entry amount is £1,000?
£1,000 only, yeah.
And how does it work if you go to the website? Is there a specific building, a specific development
that
you take a sort of bit of? And over time, you're going for some sort of, I don't know, auto bid feature that spreads your risk across a whole bunch?
Yeah, great question. The moment you pick your developments, you know that everything on there is being procured very carefully by our team. We get probably 10 to 15 proposals from developers, and of which we choose one. So we're sort of at a, you know, 1-to-10 ratio. So only the very best things make it onto the site, where we know there's great demand, where all the numbers stack up and everything makes sense. And, you know, over time, we will allow people just to auto bid and put in, you know, 10% of whatever they have with us into lots of different properties, of course. We're also going to launch a secondary market within the next sort of 6 to 12 months, so you'll be able to trade your investments. If you want to get out early, you know, you can have liquidity and trade them at any time. So it really is quite an exciting space, and as I say, we're growing very fast, user base is growing very fast, and there's been huge demand for the product, I'm pleased to say.
Excellent. And in terms of the liquidity point, because property over longer term has performed extremely well, as we were saying, but property is quite illiquid, it'd be quite hard for me to sell my house tomorrow and get the cash by the day after.
I heard it's a very nice house.
Yes, naturally, of course. But how does the liquidity thing work? So I'm just taking LendInvest as an example. I don't know what they're still doing, but when I last looked, it was something like 2 or 3 year loans maximum,
yeah,
or something. So their transactions will turn over like that, and all P2Ps say, well, you know, if there's still an inflow of money, well, and you want to get out, we'll switch you on the inflow money. But of course, if there's no inflow, you can't get out. So what potentially, if the tide starts going out, is the period that people are actually locked into one of these transactions for?
So if you don't sell it on the secondary market, you're locked in for that, as you say, two-year term. We're a bit like LendInvest, it's one stroke to 2 years. So you're locked in for the term. But if, you know, something changes in your life and you need to get the money back, this secondary market will allow you to sell it on the platform to other investors who are on the platform. And that might be at a discount or a premium to the value you went in at, a bit like the stock market. If obviously property prices have risen in the short term and things are looking better, you may well be able to get out at a premium to where you invested in, you know, months before. But if things are going not so well, then there may be a discount that you have to accept for getting out. But I guess what we feel is very valuable about that, a bit like the stock market, is we're turning something which is very liquid, such as a property stock, through technology, and actually allowing people to either have the benefit of that long-term income, or actually say, you know what, I need to change my mind, I'm getting married, I want to buy a ring, whatever, and I need that money out now, and they can do so.
Excellent. So in terms of the future of Capital Rise, as you say, it's got a very good background in terms of you guys having done this for a decade or two, which gives us some momentum. And obviously, being on the London FinTech podcast is going to be the one thing that makes it the most successful of the UK property fintechs. Oh dear, you laughed. But what are the sort of key success factors? I mean, if I was your fairy godmother and I could, you know, wave a wand and say by the end of 2018, things have fallen into place. What are the sort of key factors that you need?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really just like all things, it's the growth of investors. So we need more and more investors, such as your listeners, to understand and try these assets, because they are sort of slightly niche still. They're alternative. You know, it's not like just giving my money to a stockbroker who has been around for 100 years. You know, this is the new wave of technology. I think in 50 years' time, we will be as mainstream as your current stocks and shares, ISAs and everything else. But I think that we just need more growth in people's acceptance and understanding, and that's only going to come with regulation and obviously the peer-to-peer associations providing loan data and everything else, so people can see that these things actually perform really well and it's not some fly-by-night sort of thing that's going away. It's actually very much an alternative asset class, which is going very well. And actually, a good point there is that Capital Rise, you can invest into Capital Rise using your ISA now. So the government are seeing this, and this innovative finance ISA has come out, and you can invest in our projects using that. So you get all the returns tax-free.
And how's your FCA regulation working going?
So we are currently regulated and authorised representative under Galleon, who is, you know, regulating and checking us out. And we will eventually apply for our full registration and regulation. But at the moment, in terms of, you know, startups, getting them going as quickly as possible, that's the best thing to do, is be authorised representative of someone else.
Ah, so you haven't gone through this much vaunted sandbox?
Not yet.
No, I haven't actually met anybody who has yet. Excellent. Well, time has flown by, and UK property, as you were saying before, is worth absolutely trillions. It's a huge market, and it's one where even if you have nothing to do with FS whatsoever, you're bound to end up getting involved in one way or another, directly or indirectly. And for many people, it's the largest financial transaction of their life and incredibly important. And there's massive scope for fintech to do its digital thing, for it to reduce the length of value chains, as you were saying, for it to democratize stuff that was previously accessible only to the 1%, and to give you a smaller entry price, more flexibility, and we will see on liquidity. I'm always very skeptical on liquidity. I've seen the German government bond market when it was illiquid one afternoon, so that's just kind of being no hair and grey hair type. But I wish you every success in the future, Alex. As I say, just being in your smart offices today gives me a clear signal that you've been incredibly successful over the past decade or two, and I wish you ever success over the next couple.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. one act so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.